when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Alex Dean, and you're listening to a special emergency edition of the Prospect Podcast. The Court of Session in Edinburgh ruled on Wednesday that Boris Johnson acted unlawfully in suspending Parliament, raising profound questions about the government's behaviour, the Brexit crisis, and the integrity of our constitution. We've invited the man behind the case, barrister, director of the Good Law Project, and prominent Remainer Jolyon Maugham, to talk about where we go from here. Jolyon, thanks so much for joining us. I'm sure listeners will have seen in the headlines the ruling from Edinburgh, which, as well as judging that Johnson did not have the right to prorogue Parliament in the way that he did, I gather suggested he misled the Queen in some way.
That's right. There's this funny game going on in the courts where every woman and man in the street, the dogs in their kennels, the parrots in their cages, all know that the suspension of Parliament has got nothing at all to do with the need for a new Queen's speech and is designed to put Parliament out of the way at what Boris Johnson hoped would be a convenient moment for him. We all know that that is not true. And what the court in Edinburgh has found is that the explanation, an explanation that many of us, including me, believe was manufactured, was window dressing, given by the government to Boris Johnson and his reply, do not represent the real reason for Parliament being suspended.
And I mean, the real reason, in your view, is to shut down scrutiny of what the government's doing. So it speaks to this fundamental issue at the moment of the role of Parliament as we approach the 31st of October.
That's right. That is the sort of existential question if you're a Democrat, because here you have a man elected by 160,000 members of the Conservative Party, overwhelmingly white or male, rich, elderly, putting aside as an inconvenience a parliament elected by 35 million of us. Is that the size of the electorate? That doesn't feel terribly democratic to me. And the government's proposition here is really, really stark. What the government say is, it doesn't matter whether you believe Boris Johnson about his motive. It doesn't matter whether the suspension is for 34 days or for 34 weeks or for 34 months. It doesn't matter that Parliament does not get to choose whether or not is suspended. The only thing that matters is that this is non-justiciable. In other words, it is not something that the court can get involved with. It is fundamentally an act that is political in character. And if you think about the proposition expressed as starkly as that, and that is the necessary logical consequence of the government's argument, you understand very well what is at stake. If the government are right, it would follow that on the 1st of November, Boris Johnson could again suspend Parliament until 2022. And Parliament could not control that, and the courts could not control that. And you have to ask yourself the question, as a voter, How does that feel? Does that feel like democracy? Does that feel like elected parliamentary democracy? Does that feel like the thing that we thought we were taking back control for? Where does that leave the sort of cornerstone of the British Constitution, which is the supremacy and sovereignty of Parliament?
And so, as I gather, there's been different rulings from different courts. So the Court of Session in Edinburgh ruled one way, but English courts and courts in Belfast have ruled another way. Can you just explain what these different cases are, and are they all assessing the same thing?
I haven't yet read the decision of the court in Northern Ireland, but my understanding is that it, at least in relation to this question, follows the reasoning of the divisional court. And there is no real difference in approach between the divisional court and, if my understanding is right, the High Court of Northern Ireland on the one hand, and the inner house of the Court of Session on the other hand. Both understand the principle at stake to be this question of whether the courts can get involved, or as lawyers put it, this question of justiciability. Fundamentally, they have just taken different views as to what the answer is to that question.
So the ultimate arbiter here is going to be the Supreme Court. And can you just talk a bit about whether you're confident there and when we find out?
One of the reasons why I rush in where constitutional lawyers, more knowledgeable, more experienced, better educated, better versed in historical precedent, more academic, step in, is because I see this very clearly. I mean, I've just explained the principle as I understand it. I've explained why I think it removes the ground zero, the cornerstone, the foundation stone, whatever you want to call it, of the Constitution as we understand it in the United Kingdom. And I cannot contemplate, I genuinely cannot contemplate, that we are wrong. It follows from that, first of all, that I expect that we will win in the Supreme Court. But it also follows from that that listeners, I should say, need to understand the basis upon which I hold those expectations of the Supreme Court. I do see it in very simple terms when all's said and done.
And can we just interrogate this idea of the role of the courts in politics? Because for you, this isn't a question of something that should be legitimately confined to the political sphere. It's something where courts absolutely have a right, indeed a duty, to make their presence felt, because it taps into the law in some way. It's not just for the business of Parliament.
So there are a number of interesting facets to that question. One of them is the role of the courts in holding a balance between the considerable powers of a rather hungry executive and the supremacy, if the government is right, the notional supremacy of Parliament. But there's a bigger question than that, actually, and it was one that I was writing about back in June. Back in June, I was saying judges can see the storm coming, and they are thinking to themselves in their horsehair armchairs, what is it my role to do? Can I sit back and technocratically apply principles accretively built up in less turbulent political moments? Or is there something at stake here, sufficiently profound, sufficiently central to the life of the United Kingdom, that I have to reach beyond technocratic precedent and reach for the principles that underpin parliamentary democracy in the United Kingdom. And I said back in June that I thought that they would be more activist than the Commentary Act then credited them with. That decision was, or that call at least, was vindicated yesterday in the inner house of the Court of Session. And next week we will find out whether that call was vindicated permanently or temporarily.
So before we get to the Supreme Court, does anything change? I mean, if the government's broken the law, then does something need to give? Is Parliament going to start sitting again? Or is that not the right way to see it? And in practice, we are going to have to wait until next week.
Well, there's a rather fun moment later today, because at the Bingham Centre for the Rule of Law, the Speaker, John Bercow, is giving a talk on the role of Parliament amidst, the Brexit constitutional crisis. And as it happens, I have a ticket. And so I'm planning to ask him why it is that he says that it is for the government to recall Parliament. Because either we are right and there is no need to recall Parliament because the decision to prorogue it was annulled, and so there is nothing to recall it from, or the government is right and the decision of the inner house of the Court of Session has no legal effect for the moment, pending the decision of the Supreme Court, such that the prorogation continues like the decision of the inner house of the Court of Session never happened. But in either view of the world, there is no decision for the government to make. And so I'm pretty perplexed as to why it was that he rather hurriedly, or at least his deputy rather hurriedly, issued the statement yesterday saying that this was a matter for the government to decide whether to recall Parliament.
Do you think there's a case to be made that it never should have gotten to this point, and actually Parliament should have asserted itself far sooner? We never should have been in a position where, just weeks before crashing out, we still didn't know where we were heading. Shouldn't MPs have taken the initiative long ago?
Well, look, I mean, it's fun for me, but in a healthy, functioning body politic, lawyers don't get invited onto podcasts. The fact that people are interested, indeed fiercely engaged by the activities of campaigning lawyers, the judgments of the courts on matters as boring fundamentally as justiciability, is a sign of a really profound sickness in the functioning of our constitution. The government should not, no responsible government would, push the constitution in the way in which Theresa May did, and since then Dominic Cummings as organ grinder for Boris Johnson have.
And I guess in the background to all of this is the risk of no deal. It's always ever present, and time is very much ticking down. All these, you know, these cases take time. I know that some of them have been, as I understand it, rushed through. But clearly, we're approaching a very dangerous situation. We saw just how dangerous with the Operation Yellowhammer leak and medicine shortages, you know, build up at ports. It feels like we're teetering on the edge of something quite disastrous.
I mean, I have this discussion with those of my friends who are on the other side of the Brexit debate, and they're always a bit disarmed when I say to them, look, I've got no idea what's going to happen if we leave without a deal. Frankly, nor do you. All we can do is listen to those who do know. I, of course, as I imagine many of us do, have friends inside the civil service. And I know from how terrified they are that they think it's going to be bad. But, you know, people's appetite for risk, for economic risk, for personal risk, really is a function of how strongly they desire this outcome. So I remember saying before the Scottish independence referendum that if the only thing that held people back from voting for an independent Scotland was the notion that they might have a few pounds less in their pocket, that didn't seem to me to be a good enough reason. Now, I feel I'm not really committed to one or other side of that argument. There are lots of other reasons why one might want Scotland to stay in the Union, and obviously lots of reasons the other way as well. I suppose what I'm saying is that I try to understand the point of view of those who don't see the economic consequences of no deal as the driving force.
And for them, the driving force is the 52% that who they think voted for a hard Brexit.
Well, I don't think it's sensible. I don't think one can sensibly talk about leavers as a homogenous group. There are lots and lots of people who have lots and lots of different motivations. Some seek a, as they would describe it, a much more liberalised economy.
Singapore on Thames, as others might describe it, I suppose.
Singapore on the Thames. There will be a group who see enormous profits to be made in the market turbulence that I think we can safely assume will result from no deal and has already resulted from the vote in 2016 and the aftermath. There will be a group who do feel as though the agency that they have over their own lives is meaningfully diminished by our membership of the European Union. And no doubt there are lots and lots of other motivations as well. So I kind of resist the grand theory, the sort of the unifying theory, if you like, of leave.
If we do leave with no deal, there's been a lot of discussion about potential economic crises. And, you know, whatever you think about that, do you think we're now approaching a constitutional crisis?
The only word that I would disagree with in that question is the word approaching.
Right.
I mean, I'm really pretty pessimistic about the functioning of the United Kingdom at the level of governance, which as a sort of boring grey-haired lawyer is fundamentally what I care about. I'm more pessimistic about the United Kingdom than I am about the United States, because I see it as being very, very difficult to see where we go from here. We have a populist on the right, somebody who seems to want to turn our democracy into a sort of Turkey on the Thames, and we have a populist on the left whose manifesto, although nodding in the direction of a whole slew of policies that I would vigorously support, is also not prepared to be upfront with us about his desire for us to leave the European Union. And one of the things about the European Union in the United Kingdom is that it represents the only meaningful control on executive power. So there is no higher law in the UK against which we can hold and judge the actions of Parliament. We don't have a constitution, a written constitution, that can be used to strike down legislative excesses. The only exception to that is European Union law. And it may very well be, indeed I suspect that it is, a desire to escape from the safeguards that the European Union represents, safeguards against the erosion of values that the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn wants to erode, that lies behind his desire that we Brexit.
I mean, we are in uncharted constitutional territory when the Prime Minister is talking about breaking the law. And I gather that that's, you know, that's to do with an extension. And the Benn Act in Parliament would compel the Prime Minister to seek an extension. He said that he's not going to. Clearly something he's got to give. And that actually this is the subject of another court case that you're bringing.
So today we have issued proceedings against the Prime Minister personally in the highest court in Scotland. And those proceedings are for an order requiring him to send the letter mandated by the Benn Act, requiring him on pain of contempt proceedings, proceedings that certainly in England can lead to you going to prison, and also asking the court in Scotland to exercise a remedy, the nobile officium, which would enable the court to sign as the Prime Minister the letter asking the EU for an extension that the so-called Benn Act mandates that the Prime Minister send, but which his public statements indicate he will not send.
And the European Union would be obliged, for its part, to treat that as being as good as the signature of the Prime Minister himself?
As a matter of law, the answer to that question is yes. But of course, the EU does not have any legal obligation to say, in respect of our request for an extension, yes. And so if you are the recipient, as the heads of the 27 member states are, of that letter, in considering how you respond to it, you of course have regard to what it is that you're letting yourself in for. You have regard to the fact that you have a Prime Minister in this world that we're contemplating intent on breaking the rule of law. You have regard to the fact that the politics in the United Kingdom is extremely turbulent. We are worse than Hungary. We're worse than Poland. My description of Dominic Cummings as wanting to turn our democracy into a Turkey on the Thames was a description of what I think our democracy currently looks like. It does look like we're certainly heading towards the autocratic executive of Turkey. And, you know, it's going to have regard to the fact that the Prime Minister has been compelled to send the letter in deciding whether or not to accept.
Could one argue, though, just to play devil's advocate, that actually checks and balances are working something like they're meant to, which is that, you know, the Prime Minister did something arguably unlawful. He prorogued Parliament and lied about the intention, you know, at least that's the accusation. And the courts have gotten involved, and one of those courts has found that he did so unlawfully, and now it's going to the Supreme Court. So actually, different branches of the state are kind of, you know, even if it's a extremely rocky road, they're kind of working as designed.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that at a formalistic level. At a formalistic level, that's an accurate description of how the Constitution is functioning. But below that formal level, an immense amount of damage is being done, damage that will be very, very difficult to reverse, damage being done to trust in the rule of law, damage being done to the relationship between Parliament and the people, a whole variety of profoundly important institutions in the United Kingdom are dying on their feet.
Dorian Maugham, thank you very much.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.